Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Children cannot do all the things they're supposed to do if they have to worry about spoiling their precious clothes. Well, they wouldn't dare. They love you too much. They fear you too much.
I don't wish you to discuss my children in this manner.
Well, you've got to hear from someone. You're never home long enough to know them.
I don't want to hear any more from you about my children.
I know you don't, but you've got to.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where this week we are continuing our exploration of Robert Wise's The Sound of Music. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Rocha. I'm a writer, producer, host, and voiceover artist in San Diego, California. And once upon a time, Steve, I used to go by a nickname called The Outlaw in The Schmodown. And if I had seen this movie before The Schmodown, for my last match, I would have had people walk out in the masks and sing, "How do you solve a problem like the outlaw?" I mean, that would have been perfect.
Yes.
I'm even madder that I did not see this movie before this particular podcast.
The whole world would be different if you had seen it. And by the way, if you want to support the work we're doing on this fine podcast, the best way to do it is at patreon.com/thecinephiles or through Apple Podcasts, where you can get all sorts of benefits, including ad-free versions of the show and our Cinephile shorts. And on Patreon, there are additional tiers that give you access to ask us questions that will appear in shows. And of course, our Cinephiles Advisory Board, which helps plan the future of the Cinephiles.
Yeah, I mean, certainly were instrumental in getting us to talk about The Sound of Music. So thank you to the Advisory Board as well. And for those of you who want to support us through our sponsors, you know, they offer some really amazing products. Please remember to use our code. If you use our code, it keeps them coming back to hang out with us and support everything we're doing here on the Cinephile. So if you hear us talking about any of those products or you hear those commercials and you want to try them out, just want to encourage you all to remember to use our code to get massive discounts on that stuff.
And where we left off with the story of Maria and the Von Trapp family is that she had just comforted the kids and really bonded with them during a thunderstorm and then got essentially scolded by Captain Von Trapp, who felt that she was disobeying orders. And we know that the one thing that she really wanted was to get them some clothes that they can play in.
Yes.
We know that she can make her own dresses. She asked for more fabric. The drapes she found out in her room are getting replaced, even though they're perfectly fine. And in the last moment, in what I think is absolutely spot on storytelling, we see her see those drapes and sing defiantly the end of Favorite Things. And we know exactly what she's going to do.
Yeah.
Cut to, they walk outside, Maria with her guitar and a new outfit, and all the kids wearing the drapes.
I love it. Did you have play clothes growing up? I don't even remember having play clothes.
I had formal clothes. All clothes were play clothes. And then my grandmother took me to Young Man's Fancy in San Francisco to get a suit. Yes.
Oh, yes.
If you were a Jewish kid growing up in San Francisco, your grandmother took you to Young Man's Fancy. That was just a thing. And maybe the Christian kids and other kids went there as well. I would have no way of knowing, but it was certainly every Jewish kid I knew had a suit from Young Man's Fancy.
Yeah, I think the first time I remember going into a clothing store to get clothes was for a suit, but it was also the first time I remember the term husky being applied to my size, which is a debilitating word to hear when you're a kid, man. I'm telling you.
Or big boned.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, terrible. Terrible. But we are not actually here to discuss our own childhood traumas with clothing.
We're not.
We are here to discuss this outfit. And I have to say,
yeah,
I'm firmly in the Captain Von Trapp camp. just in the sense that these are really ugly outfits that these kids are going out into Salzburg. And like, I mean, he's a jerk, clearly, yeah, at the beginning of this film, but I don't like these outfits. I think they're hideous, and they're hideous in a perfect and wonderful way for the film.
Yeah, I agreed. It was good color scheme, bright color scheme, but it works. And the idea of using the curtains, I think, was really funny. And there's a weird kind of uniformity to it all, right? And the idea that they've got essentially kind of, they have a military father, but sort of a military upbringing. The fact that Maria encourages them to wear the same kind of outfits, they're joyfully doing it. Whereas I think they're not necessarily joyful in following all of Captain Von Trapp's rules there in the military sense. Yeah.
And if you thought Salzburg looked beautiful as we move into the world during, you know, the opening credits or when Maria sings Confidence and is leaving to go to the Von Trapp, now you, this is just a love song to this location. Every single shot is just amazing and beautiful. And you go, I want to go there.
Yeah.
So gorgeous. Yeah. And we see them all going through the town, all having lots of fun. We end up at like a fruit stand. Here's one interesting thing about this that I never would have thought of, is that one of the fruits that is there is their big boxes of oranges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the place that Europe was getting big boxes of oranges in the 60s is Israel.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. They weren't getting big boxes of oranges in the 30s because that was this big industry that was created in Israel after it became a state. And Robert Wise commented on this, and that they made sure to not show the bottom of the boxes where you could see the big, that it said Israel on it, but that it was very weird making this movie about Nazis when having one of their props be oranges from Israel.
Wow.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah, that is totally weird. Interesting.
Yeah.
Would you say, have you had an orange from Israel? Would you say that they...
I've been to Israel. And so, yes. Okay. I had many oranges from Israel. I was just reading a book about Israel recently because I'm trying to learn more about all the different sides of the horrible things that are going on there.
Oh,
right,
sure,
now.
Of course. Yeah.
And I really didn't know how important oranges were to establishing the state of Israel. It was their first major export industry. They were just killing it in terms of growing oranges.
Wow. I had no idea that oranges were a massive
export
from Israel. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay.
But this is not a podcast about the economy of the early state of Israel. This is a podcast about The Sound of Music. And we see some cute stuff where we're kind of tossing fruit. And then she tosses a tomato to Gretel, who doesn't catch it. And it drops and breaks. And you can see in this little girl's performance everything about the consequences for making a mistake in the house of Captain Von Trapp in this moment.
Yeah. And those of us who've lived in a kind of strict environment growing up, I think we all know that face. Once you make a mistake, that whole shame face that comes on to you for sure. And I love that you have the moment. This was a really sweet moment to see in the film, to have Maria put the finger up to make her smile, because it's not a big deal.
You know, it's funny. I shouldn't digress, but we've got a lot of movie to get through. Exactly. We've barely gotten anywhere. We've had multiple digressions into clothing, the state of Israel. And here's another one. I think that talking about that moment, the Cinephiles are the only podcast that takes the time, because nobody else goes through a movie like we do.
Yeah, true.
And so nobody else would ever, you would never focus on the moment that Gretel didn't catch a tomato. It's not, it's totally not important to the vast scope of the film, but it's a perfect moment in terms of showing the characters and what Maria is bringing to this family.
Yes, 100%.
As they move through Salzburg, there was initially a scene where they ran into Rolf.
Oh,
yeah, and to just advance that story, and they cut it because they just felt that this was really about Maria bonding with the kids. Rolf wasn't important at this moment, and we see them, you know, riding in a train and waving to people. They reach the mountaintop, where they're playing ball on the mountaintop. It is just, saying it's spectacular is just, again, it's redundant at this point.
Yeah.
But the way that they get both the kids and Maria, and those mountains towering over them and the clouds, it's not easy to film this kind of stuff, and it's spectacular.
Now, was this all shot location-wise, or was
this is all location, yeah.
Because this is fascinating, because some of those shots where they're on the mountain, it looks like they've laid out grass in the Paramount lot and painted the wall. So that literally makes it picturesque. It is so beautiful that it looks almost like it's a matte painting when it's the real life. Fascinating.
And by the way, you know, this is not easy because you have to get up the mountain, and frequently it was pouring rain. And so the trucks couldn't get up through the mud. And so they went up on oxen carts to get the cast up to the top of the mountain. And then because you have this big expanse, it means most of the crew is all way out of sight.
Wow.
You know, because it's, you got to have the space to show this big expanse here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Interesting. Really beautiful stuff.
Okay. I haven't had so much fun since the day he put glue on Fräulein Josephine's toothbrush.
I can't understand how children as nice as you can manage to play such awful tricks on people.
And she asked why they do it. And their answer, which we mentioned in the first part, is so important, which is they say,
well, how else can we get Father's attention?
That's the window into it all right there, right? Because watching it, you're asking yourself, how could they do this? And then, boom, there's the answer. And that really hits you like a ton of bricks.
And I love Maria's response because she says,
oh, I see. Well, we'll have to think about that one.
Yeah.
Like what I love about Maria is that she goes, like, it's funny. I hadn't thought about it this way.
Mm.
The second song in the movie is how do you solve a problem like Maria?
Yeah.
And the solution to the problem of Maria is to give Maria a problem to solve.
Yeah.
That's what she needs.
Great point. She needs something to focus her mind on to fix.
Yep.
And that'll keep her from doing the other things because she's a fidgety person. She wants to be working on it. Yeah.
And they talk about what are they going to do. And Maria comes up with the idea of singing to the Baroness.
Father doesn't like us to sing.
Well, perhaps we can change his mind. Now, what songs do you know?
We don't know any songs.
So here's what's really funny when you listen to lots of commentary tracks and behind the scenes things is you hear totally contradictory stories. So the Julie Andrews story was she really struggled to learn the guitar. It was very, very difficult. Oh. She'd never played it before. And in particular, you know, she had to sing while playing the guitar, and coordinating those two things was almost impossible. So she says, frankly, that she mostly just faked it and hoped that they just, you know, didn't shoot her fingers because she wasn't really doing it right.
Right.
Robert Wise says she was brilliant at everything she did and mastered the guitar with no problem whatsoever. And my guess is the truth is somewhere in the middle. She wasn't as good as Robert Wise said. It wasn't as, you know, you're an actor. You know that you're like, oh, I didn't do that right. You know, like that, all that feeling is very common for an actor to feel. And but it's always funny when you hear two different stories, you know.
And great directors always take care of their actors. And, you know, pushing the narrative that she was amazing at everything. That's a common PR move. And that's still going on today. How these great actors all of a sudden can, like, oh, yeah, I studied for 3 months and I'm as good as anybody doing this particular thing that takes years to get great at. So these are narratives that get pushed all the time. You understand it.
Yeah. And then we go into Do Re Mi.
Let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start. When you read, you begin with
A, B, C.
When you sing, you begin with Do Re Mi.
Do, re, mi.
Do, re, mi. The first three notes just happen to be Do, re, mi.
Do, re, mi.
Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti.
And it's so funny. I have a personal story. I'll tell you my personal story about Do, re, mi and my experience with it and then how my thoughts evolved on it. So with here is my, we both acted as kids. My very first performance in front of an audience was Do Re Mi. I was 6 years old. I was in Indian Guides, which seems like a weird thing to think about, like all these kids dressing up as, you know, 6 year olds dressing up as Indians.
Yeah.
Looks feels a little weird, but I was in Indian Guides.
Sure.
And Dr. Mathis, who was our chief, came up with this idea. And it was, I don't even think I had heard the term lip sync, but we lip sunk Do Re Mi. And I was like the conductor. So I was the lead singing it, and all of the other Indian guides were singing their parts, and that is my first performance on a stage.
Wow.
Yeah. And naturally, I thought Do Re Mi was a pretty stupid song. As soon as I transitioned to like a teenager, I was like, it's such a kid song. And then more recently, I was listening to it. I'm like, wait, I think this song might be brilliant, like a thing of pure genius. And I talked to Wendy Cooper, who's a good friend of ours, who's a professional voice teacher. And I asked her about it, and she's like, no, that song is amazing. Because what it actually is doing is taking this very, very simple truth about music and then expanding it and playing with it and reversing it and changing it and evolving it and doing all this stuff with it in this kind of fun kid song.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic analysis, Wendy, for sure.
And she then introduces them to Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do.
Sure.
But she does it by giving each one a little phrase, a little thing to know about it.
Do, a deer, a female deer. Re, a drop of golden sun. Me, a name I call myself, far, a long, long way to run. So, a needle pulling thread, la, a note to follow, so, tea, a drink with jam and bread, that will bring us back to do, oh, oh, oh.
I love, by the way, and I really wish I had Oscar Hammerstein around so I could ask him this question, which is that she gets to, you know, so, a needle pulling thread, got it, and then la, a note to follow, so. And that just seems like I wonder how much time Oscar Hammerstein spent trying to come up with a meaning for law. And my guess is maybe a note to follow so was like a placeholder because he couldn't figure anything out. And then it just ended up staying in this. I would love to ask this question. And maybe it's not that at all.
So, a needle pulling thread. La, a note to follow so. Tea, a drink with jam and bread. That will bring us back to dough.
By the way, there is some controversy, again, just like the guitar thing, about how much of this is really those kids singing and how much is professional voices that they brought in.
Oh, okay.
Charmaine Carr says it's almost all them.
Yeah.
Other sources say it might not be that much of them at all.
Wow.
I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Well, when they get together for these reunions that are on video, do they sound good together? I wonder if you see them. So
I've seen them together many times. I haven't actually seen them singing.
That's a giveaway. I think that is a giveaway.
Well, I don't have any evidence. You know, like that doesn't mean I've watched all the times that they've got together, which is a ton.
Oh, no, I'm taking that as law, though.
Okay.
That's fact. They can't sing.
Now we're at a different location with different outfits. We've learned the basic notes, and now we do a new evolution of Do, Re, Mi.
Once you have these notes in your heads, you can sing a million different tunes by mixing them up. Like this.
So, do, la, fa, mi, do, re.
Can you do that?
So, do, la, fa, mi, do, re.
And then the next objection is it doesn't mean anything. And then she adds words to the melody that she just created. And now we have lyrics to our song.
When you know the notes to sing, you can sing most anything together.
When you know the notes to sing, you can sing most anything.
And now, and the one that's really impressive to me is the one where they're riding bikes. Think, because this is choreography. And so it's choreography on a bike on a street in Salzburg where they have to speed up and catch up at exactly the right moments together.
Yeah.
It seems really, really hard.
Yeah.
One of the things that's happening, by the way, is that the choreographers have to go to each of these locations to work all this stuff out. And so because you have to know, like if we're going to cross the street or something on this verse, well, that verse has a certain number of beats, which means because there's a certain rhythm to it, there's a certain number of steps. Is the street the right width to have the right number of steps to get across it when you are doing the choreography? And so the choreographers are walking around the cities of Salzburg, and one of them is dancing everything out. And at one point, a policeman comes up and says, "What are you doing?" And they don't, he doesn't speak English. And the guy kind of speaks German and is trying to explain, "We're here for this movie, and I have to figure out how many steps to go across the street. So I keep dancing back and forth trying to work it out." You do weird things making a movie.
Yes, you do. And you have to deal with these things, the outside forces of it all to make it happen for sure.
There's this one particular park whose name I don't remember, but it's a lot of the locations are there. The fountain is there and the steps are there. When the choreographers get to the steps, they count the steps and they go, there are seven steps and we have seven notes.
Oh.
And that is just perfect for them to use for that particular piece of choreography. And we're coming to the big finale, and Julie Andrews goes for this ridiculous high note where she kind of puts her hand on the head at the end. And she went to the arranger of the music, and it was her idea. So what if I go to this note? And he was like, "Can you?"
But I mean, the song is really good because like the beginning of the song is the beginning of their relationship, right? How do we start over, or how do we start build something from scratch? You have to start at the beginning. And so as they're getting closer to her, they're constructing the song. So in essence, this is a reflection of their coming together as a bunch of notes to form an overall bar of music. And they're all and led by her as, in essence, the conductor, you know. So it's a fascinating thing as you're watching them get closer and closer with each other through a really catchy song.
You know, what's just occurred to me, maybe this is the weirdest, it's not the weirdest metaphor that's ever been on the Cinephiles, but it's a little weird, but I suddenly went, you know what, this is kind of Mr. Miyagi and wax, you know, sand the fence or wax the car, because you're taking these, what the song is here are these parts.
Yeah.
And you don't really know what the parts mean, but then the parts magically become a song. And it's also through that relationship with Mr. Miyagi, that's how they bond through to that moment where they're actually, he's actually blocking punches. This is they bond through this moment where they're actually performing this song together, yeah. You know?
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Cut to car driving up. It's a beautiful, beautiful convertible. And there is Captain Von Trapp with the Baroness and Max.
Mountains are magnificent, Georg. Really magnificent.
I had to put them just for you, darling.
Oh.
Even if it's to a height of 10,000 feet, Georg always believes in rising to the occasion.
Oh. Unless the jokes improve, Max, I'm taking back my invitation.
You didn't invite me to your villa. I invited myself.
Naturally.
Now, the Baroness is played by Eleanor Parker. This is an interesting thing I didn't know about Eleanor Parker. She was nominated for 3 Academy Awards for her roles in Caged in 1950, Detective Story in 1951, and Interrupted Melody in 1955. I got to say, I've only ever heard of Detective Story, and that's barely of all these choices of films, but she was nominated 3 times. She was also known for her roles in the films of Human Bondage, Scaramouche, which from 1952, The Naked Jungle, A Man with the Golden Arm. The Man with the Golden Arm, that's the one with Sinatra. A Hole in the Head is also Sinatra. It's a comedy with him. And the Oscar, along with The Sound of Music. So, I mean, she worked with people like Errol Flynn, Humphrey Bogart, Ronald Reagan, Kirk Douglas, Glenn Ford, Sinatra, and with directors like William Wyler, Capra, and Preminger. She even has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And towards the end of her life, she embraced and was a supporter of Messianic Jewish philosopher, teacher, and commentator Roy Masters, who's owner of the Foundation of Human Understanding in Grants Pass, Oregon. And in 1978, she even wrote the foreword to Masters' book, How Your Mind Can Keep You Well. So, very educated, smart, and very talented woman. She turned down numerous offers to go, in essence, pro as an actress because she felt she wasn't ready. She was offered contracts from 20th Century Fox and another studio while she was still learning how to become an actress. And refused to sign the contracts until she had done some stage plays and really understood how to be an actor and understand that she was good and merited the contract. So after the run there in the 50s, she never really kind of hit the heights that she had during that time. But an actress that's maybe a little bit lost to history in terms of her accomplishments, but one that should very well be respected and delivers an interesting performance here.
I will say, I think she's, the more I watch her, the more I think she's great. Because it's really, she does this totally bizarre thing, which is to do horrible things in the movie. And yet I still have sympathy with her, you know, multiple times.
I know. And watching it this is my first time watching it. So I think if I watched it when I was younger, I would have hated her more. But watching it at this older age, like I understand what she's doing. And I don't think she's being overtly evil. This is a battle for someone she wants. And so, yes, you want to default to Maria, but this woman has a right. She was there first. She has a right to stake claim on her man and try to figure out if this works for her. And so I kind of have a lot of sympathy for what she's doing. And she didn't do what the woman in American in Paris does, right? The older woman who wants Gene Kelly, like she manipulates the situation in order to try to destroy everyone around Gene Kelly so that he's dependent on her. And I think that's the difference here. That whereas the Baroness is, I think, much more understanding of the situation as it progresses. And later when he dumps her, and he does dump her, she gets it and she does not.
That seems so good.
It is. And yeah. she does not look for she does not try to be vindictive. She understands it. And so I love this character very much as I was watching it in the movie. I thought it was a breath of fresh air to see a character like this that didn't slide into mustache twirling stereotype.
And of course, the other person in the back seat who I adore every second he's on screen is Max, played by Richard Hayden.
And Richard Hayden, some of his best performances, some of y'all may know him as the Caterpillar in Alice in Wonderland. He voiced the Caterpillar. He was Baron Popoff in The Merry Widow, William Brown in Mutiny on the Bounty in 1962. He also had a small role, one of the last two roles he did on film in Young Frankenstein. He plays Herr Falkstein. That is him. Yes. And in The Twilight Zone, one of the famous episodes of The Twilight Zone, it's called A Thing About Machines. That's the episode. He portrayed Mr. Bartlett Finchley, who was a quirky, self-absorbed technophobe who was confronted by every machine in his home. And I remember that episode distinctly. Yeah. So a gentleman who was well-known for doing stuff in front of the microphone and on screen in numerous arenas.
He's also in one of my favorite episodes of The Dick Van Dyke Show, which is called The Return of Edwin Karp.
Okay.
Where it's bringing back all these old radio and vaudeville comedians to appear on The Alan Brady Show. And he is a specialist in fish impressions, Edwin Karp. And he's really, really funny.
You needed a chaperone, and I needed a place to stay where the cuisine is superb, the wine cellar unexcelled, and the price perfect.
Max, you are outrageous.
Not at all. I'm a very charming sponge.
And Max is outrageous.
Yeah.
And I want to bring up something about his character that I have always felt, or maybe not always felt, but as an adult have always felt. And I finally, had to go online and say, have other people had this thought? And yes, many, many people have this thought, which is Max is such a particular stereotypical gay man of a certain era. And they never say that he is gay, but all of the way his sense of humor works, the love of style and grace and excellence and he has this relationship with this woman who clearly it's her best friend, and he goes to the fanciest parties, even though he doesn't have a lot of money. And it's fills out, without ever saying it, this kind of a character who is very, very familiar, you know?
Without using the terms that we've heard use over the years to describe a person like this in a woman's life, he is that, right? And again, first time watching the movie, that immediately radiated off the screen that he is her gay best friend. And that's why he goes with her everywhere, because in essence, he's a sounding board for her. He supports her 100% and wants her to get what she can. But also, he is also a businessman. And when he sees an opportunity, he will embrace it and try and go and get it with everything he's got. So it's an interesting character here to have as a sounding board. I wonder if maybe this was, done on purpose.
I think so.
In a way, to kind of have these interactions and give the Baroness much more dimension than she might not have had if she didn't have someone there.
And speaking of his business, we find out pretty instantly what it is, because he overhears a choir from a neighboring monastery, and he says,
somewhere a hungry little singing group is waiting for Max Detweiler to pluck it out of obscurity and make it famous at the Salzburg Folk Festival.
They get the fame, you get the money.
'Tis unfair, I admit it. But someday that'll be changed. I shall get the fame, too.
And as we're driving, we start to hear laughter. And we drive by, very quickly, a bunch of kids in some unusual outfits who are climbing trees and laughing.
Good heavens, what's this?
It's nothing, just some local urchins.
And you see Christopher Plummer does a perfect little almost a take, you know? It's later on, the captain and the Baroness are walking along the water. What do you think of his performance, or I think it's a performance on both levels. Christopher Plummer's performance as Georg in this situation, and what I would call Georg's performance of being a romantic partner with the Baroness. What do you think about what his character is doing?
It feels, when I was watching it, it felt like he's going through the motions a little bit, because this is what he's supposed to do. And he does have feelings for her as a person, but it does not radiate feelings for her like we're going to see when he dances with Maria, right? Like there's not that electricity. Like Michael, when he sees Apollonia the first time in Godfather, like there's not that electricity that's part. But there is a sort of like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do, you know? And listen, he's recovering from the loss of a wife. He's got 7 children. There are demands on his life and his situation. So
He's exploring his possibilities, is the way I look at it.
You know what? You put it exactly right. He's doing the stuff, but there is no spark. You know, like that's the key. There's just nothing underneath any of this.
This really is exciting for me, Georg, being here with you.
Trees, lakes, mountains. When you've seen one, you've seen them all.
That is not what I mean, and you know it.
Ah, you mean me. I'm exciting.
Is that so impossible?
No, just highly improbable.
His personality's odd. It's like he's code switching from the disciplinarian that he feels that he needs to be for his kids to the quote unquote romantic partner that he feels that he needs to be towards the Baroness. And none of them are true.
People are going to get weirded out by what I'm about to say, but I'm going to say it. And that is, if you watch Christopher Plummer in Dragnet, there are beats he does in this movie that he does in Dragnet for that character as well. It's just that that character is a villain in that movie. He is, and he's a hero in this. Well, to a degree, a hero in this movie. But some
by the end.
What's that? Yeah, at the end.
By the end, totally.
But some of the stuff he's doing, some of the moments, some of the closed-lipped looks and noises and movements are a little similar to some of the stuff he does in Dragnet, which I know is a crazy comparison to make, but go and watch Dragnet and his scenes and tell me I'm wrong, because I might do a quick video where I compare the two, which could be a lot of fun to see the similarities in the performance. So you know, it's going through the motions, you know?
You know what I sense in the future, John? I sense a Dragnet watch-along for Patreon.
Shut up. I would love to do that.
Let's do it.
I love that movie so much.
I watched it again probably 5 years ago after it came up, because it's come up many times on the podcast.
I know. I love them.
And I totally liked it.
Yep.
Yeah. And I can still quote the song.
Hell yeah. Yeah. That song is a classic. People don't give it enough love.
Are you trying to say that I'm more at home here among the birds and the flowers and the wind that moves through the trees like a restless sea?
Hmm? How poetic.
Yes, it was rather, wasn't it?
He's going through the motions of what he's supposed to do. And but you sense there's not a lot of feeling to it. And Plummer has to play this correctly, you know, because you have to see the differences from when he sees Maria to when he's dealing with the Baroness.
Yeah. And then we hear what her world is like.
More at home here than in Vienna, in all your glittering salons, gossiping gaily with bores I detest, soaking myself in champagne, stumbling about the waltzes by Strauss's, I can't even remember. Is that what you're trying to say?
More or less, yes.
Right, just with that line, it's like, this is not a match.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Because that is her world. That is the beautiful, spectacular, wealthy world that she lives and loves.
Yeah, listen, no, we can't control what situation we're born into in life. Like, right? But like, if you like your situation, if you love your situation, you want to be with someone who doesn't crap on your situation and make you ashamed of your situation, you know? And so I think that's a great point you bring up, Steve. He's immediately, maybe in a passive aggressive way, making it very clear that he does not have feelings for her, but this might be a marriage of convenience if he goes through with it.
Oh, I hope that's why you've been coming to Vienna so often. Or were there other distractions there?
Oh, I'd hardly call you a mere distraction, darling.
Well, what would you call me, Georg?
This, by the way, if you're dating someone and they say, what would you call me? Get it right.
Lovely. Charming, witty, graceful, the perfect hostess. And you're going to hate me for this. In a way, my savior.
Do.
I don't think we can underestimate how sad Georg was at the death of his wife.
Yeah, it's not really, there's not a moment where he really, you know, kind of it reveals all of it, right? But it's there and you can sense it and you can feel it. And so in his interactions, that's what it tells you more about the situation than any words could, you know?
Here's what I think happened. I think he was really, really down and it was really, really bad. And then he went to some party in Vienna and met her and her fabulous world and fabulous lifestyle. And I think that word distraction is actually the right word. Is suddenly he didn't feel so bad. And so he goes, grabs onto it like a life preserver.
Yeah.
It's like your rebound fling. You're so desperate for something and he found something and maybe this is what I need, but it isn't.
Well, I would be an ungrateful wretch if I didn't tell you at least once that it was you who brought some meaning back into my life.
Which was lovely and nice.
some meaning, not the meaning.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Georg heads away, and Max says conspiratorially,
"Well? Well, what? Have you made up Georg's mind yet? Do I hear wedding bells?
Pealing madly.
Marvelous.
But not necessarily for me.
What kind of talk's that?
How much do you think the Baroness senses that there's something isn't quite 100% right with how Georg's feelings for her?
Yeah, I think she senses it, but she's also lonely, it seems like. And so people will convince themselves of anything when they're in, you know, a lonely place and they want to be with somebody. And this is no judgment or offense to anybody who's done it. That's just life and for some people. And so, yeah, I think she senses it, but like some people are, they're willing to ignore red flags because they want to be with somebody. And so you see that here in this situation. There's nothing he's done has been overtly affectionate or caring necessarily, but he's been respectful, just not, you know, caring.
Yeah.
Intimate.
Oh, come on. Tell Max every teensy, weensy, intimate, disgusting detail.
And Max, it very typical of this relationship, obviously, is, you know, pushing her for more details and more gossip and more information. And she finally says that she thinks she's here on approval, which is another interesting line.
If I know you, darling, and I do, you will find a way.
Oh, he's no ordinary man.
Oh, he's rich.
When his wife died, she left him with a terrible heartache.
And when your husband died, he left you with a terrible fortune.
Everybody needs a Max in their life, I think.
Yeah.
I've had many.
Oh, you've had many Maxes in your life?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I
only have one.
Michael Vogel?
Yeah. Michael Vogel. He's the bane of my existence, even though I love him. You can keep that in.
Rolf rides up, throws stones at the window, and then gets caught by Captain Von Trapp.
What are you doing there?
Oh, Captain Von Trapp. I was just looking for...
I didn't see. I mean, I didn't know you were...
And he's obviously feeling awkward and embarrassed because he was throwing stones at the window and he doesn't know what to do. And then he raises up his hand and says,
Heil Hitler.
Yeah, out of nowhere, right? Because we're in this place of like figuring everybody out where they stand. And then boom, he does that. And we had just seen him dancing with Louisa in a beautiful gazebo and doing all of that. And now he's immediately boom. And it's a great moment for the movie. Because we are kind of snapped out of our bliss that we're in with these characters.
Now, how much did you know about the movie? Did you know Nazis were involved?
I knew Nazis. People that always reference Nazis, but I didn't know what level they were involved in. And I certainly didn't know that the characters in the movie would become sympathizers and turn it. I thought it was more a matter of like a Helen Keller situation where they were chased out and almost killed. But I didn't know, I think for years I believed that they were killed at the end, the kids and everything. So I had no idea the role the Nazis played in the film, but I know the Nazis were a part of the film.
I think the movie does it masterfully, mm-hmm. which is that it's a totally romantic, sweet film.
Yeah.
And that's the story. The story is Maria and these kids and family members singing songs, and it's all lovely.
Sure.
And then you have this moment where Rolf talks to Franz, the butler.
Yeah.
And there's like talks about, oh, is there news? Why I can't share it? Oh, what's that about? And then you have the moment with Rolf and Liesl where he goes, you know, I'm worried about your father. There's people and we hear these little things, but we haven't said Nazis yet. We
right.
don't know anything yet. And then this is the next one. And when he goes Heil Hitler, it's like, in my nice little romantic, sweet, loving movie about kids, and we just did Doe a Deer. And now kid raises his arm and yells, Heil Hitler. It's rough. It's yeah. like, oh my God, you know?
Who are you?
I have a telegram for Herr Detweiler.
I'm Herr Detweiler.
Yes, sir.
Georg just grabs the telegram out of his hand.
All right, you've delivered your telegram. Now get out.
I think it's also the kind of the first moment where we like Georg, you know?
Yeah.
Although he is scary. Well, and I think too, like, the way I've seen the movie so many times, I don't know that this was my reaction. Maybe I'll ask if this was your reaction.
Mm.
Is like, I think where I am is going, oh, we've messed up the romantic relationship with Rolf.
Mm.
Like, I'm more thinking about that than I'm thinking about Nazis are going to come to get us. You know?
I think, you know, what I thought when I saw this sequence was trepidation. I felt trepidation. Like, they just finished having this beautiful duet just a few minutes ago in the movie, and here he is showing up with a Heil Hitler. And this was a guy who initially was presented to us as a person who cared about this family and wanted to do what was best for the family. But
yeah,
when he does that move, you immediately are like, oh no, what does this mean?
Oh, Georg, he's just a boy.
Yes, and I'm just an Austrian.
And then this next moment, man, you're starting to see where Georg's character is going to go.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is going to happen. Just make sure it doesn't happen to you. Max, don't you ever say that again.
It's a rough moment.
Yeah.
It shows us that he's got a very strong feeling about this situation. And later when he talks to Herzella, the same thing. And listen, there are people, we need to have people like this who are going to be clear about what this threat is and are not willing to just blow it off so they can enjoy a Saturday. Got to have the balance. And people like this who know what's coming, it's important to listen. And that's what he's essentially telling Max. Like, you can play around about everything else. This is serious.
You know I have no political convictions. Can I help it if other people do?
Oh, yes, you can help it. You must help it.
And then we hear some kids laughing. And they look up, and out on a boat in a lake, we see all the kids dressed back in their beautiful drapery outfits and Maria, and they're singing and laughing and having so much fun. And Georg looks up and sees them, and he is shocked and angry, and they see him. And what do you do in a boat full of kids when you see somebody? Y'all stand up.
Oh, Captain, you're home.
Not a good choice. The boat goes over and all of them fall in. By the way, the little girl that plays Gretel did not know how to swim. And so they go into the water and Bob Weiss just tells Julie Andrews, this is not how you would do this today. Hey, make sure to grab Gretel because otherwise she'll drown, you know? So Julie Andrews goes to grab Gretel, who's gone underwater and swallowed a bunch of water, and picks her up, and Gretel immediately pukes all that water up on Julie Andrews.
Oh.
Yeah, and it sounds like they did three takes of this. And so you see there's a very, I think this, the one that's in the movie is the first take, and you'll see it's a very quick shot when they go into the water, and then they cut to later. It was also quite cold, the water. And they're all laughing as they're coming out of the water. He whistles, and the laughter stops, and all the kids line up. And he also, I think it's Brigitte, is wearing the little scarf, or maybe it's Louisa, I'm not sure which one. And he pulls that scarf off, which obviously he's very mad about this. And he sends them off to go inside and clean up. And Maria, disappointed, starts to go.
Fräulein, you will stay here, please.
And the Baroness immediately goes, I gotta get out of here. So she leaves, and we're left with just the two of them.
Yeah, I love this scene that we're about to talk about.
It's a great scene.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they rehearsed it a lot. So she and Christopher Plummer, they worked it and they worked it and they worked it to really get it to this place. Here's what's crazy about this. So we're in an over-the-shoulder for most of this, which means that we're looking past Christopher Plummer's shoulder to Julie Andrews and past Julie Andrews' shoulder to Christopher Plummer. They wanted a house that was on a lake. They found a beautiful house and they found a beautiful lake, but they did not find a house and a lake. So every shot with the house in the background is shot at the villa where they filmed everything else. Every shot with the lake in the background was shot on a different day at a different location.
Oh, interesting.
So you, and you know this as an actor, it's you have to be good to just act in a scene. But to act in the same scene in two different days at two different locations and have those conversations match is really, really hard.
Yes.
And of course, they also had to keep just dumping buckets of water on Julie Andrews because she had to be wet for the whole thing, which on a not hot day, which it was not a hot day, it was a cold day, and you're shooting for 6 hours wet, that's rough. It's hard to do.
Now, Fräulein, I want a truthful answer from you.
Yes, Captain.
Is it possible, or could I have just imagined it? Have my children, by any chance, been climbing trees today?
And you think that she is going to shatter under this pressure, that she is going to break down, that she's going to apologize, that she is going to backtrack or try to manipulate or lessen, and she doesn't at all. She is smiling, she is 100% confident, or seems confident, and says,
yes, Captain.
I see. And where, may I ask, did they get these...
play clothes.
And again, with total confidence.
Yeah.
How much did Maria think about this confrontation in the time that Georg has been gone?
Oof, that's a great question. I'm sure it was a lingering thought. throughout her day. I don't know how much, though, to quantify how much she was thinking about it.
I think she thought about it a lot. I think she went through and she went, this is what I mean about, like, she had a problem to solve. She's like, right. When he comes back, I will probably get in trouble. I will probably get yelled at because this is not what he wanted.
Right.
And I have to be strong in front of it. Because you know what the other thing that Maria has that's amazing? She has the fucking courage of her convictions. She knows she's right.
Yeah. She's very clear about this. This is what I like about her character. When she rebels from a place that makes sense and you can understand her point of view. So yeah, 100%.
I made them from the drapes that used to hang in my bedroom.
Now that is... It's like you, because this is a wealthy, very prominent family. It's like you put them in drapes.
They still had plenty of wear left. The children have been everywhere in them.
So now it's not just they're playing, which you told them not to do. She made clothes out of the drapery, which not so cool for a wealthy family. And then now he finds out that they've been in public.
Do you mean to tell me that my children have been roaming about Salzburg dressed up in nothing but some old drapes?
And she, with just the biggest smile on her face, says,
mm-hmm. And having a marvelous time.
They have uniforms.
Oh, straitjackets, if you'll forgive me.
She gives him no quarter.
Nope.
And she knows exactly where he's going, which I think is great.
And then she lets him have it.
I will not forgive you for that.
Children cannot do all the things they're supposed to do if they have to worry about spoiling their precious clothes. Well, they wouldn't dare. They love you too much. They fear you too much.
I don't wish you to discuss my children in this manner.
Well, you've got to hear from someone. You're never home long enough to know them.
I don't want to hear any more from you about my children.
I know you don't, but you've got to.
It's great.
Which startles him a little bit. If you watch, there's a little micro moment of emotion that Christopher Plummer plays that moment when she says they're frightened. Because I think inside, it's the last thing he wants. He wants to be listened to out of the fear and the grief, but he doesn't want his kids to fear him. You know, there's a difference. Yeah.
This is where I go, like, Maria, I don't know what her last name is before she becomes Maria von Trapp.
Yeah.
But Maria von Trapp is so much more of a hero than Mary Poppins.
Ooh, that's a good, Yes, because she's more invested in it, in this situation. Now, although she loves the kids in Mary Poppins, she's probably moving off to other kids after she's done with those two kids, right?
It's also... Maria's not safe, you know?
Yeah, right.
Maria has nothing. You know, Maria doesn't... Mary Poppins has super... It's like Superman versus Batman. It's like Mary Poppins can do whatever she wants.
Yes.
She has magical superpowers. She knows everything.
Yeah.
You get the sense that she's done this with children after children after children, and then she goes to the next place, and she is never under threat. This Maria is a normal human who we first saw saying she's being scared and saying, I have to have confidence, you know?
It's a massive situation. It's an interesting situation, rather. I mean, how do you pitch Julie Andrews on this? Well, you're going to be another governess. Your name is going to be Maria, not Mary. You're going to sing. You know, I mean, I wonder if there was a feeling for her of being typecast. And so maybe a concern this early in her career, but I mean,
she says after this, that was all she got offered.
Oh, really? Well, that makes sense because you doubled down on it. You know? Yeah.
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 Well, and she won the Oscar for Mary Poppins.
Right.
I mean, like,
right.
You know, so it's not just that she doubled down. It's that, and then she's in the most successful movie of all time.
Right.
It's hard not to get typecast.
I think that's what leads to Victor Victoria when she does nudity in the film. It was a way of her trying to break out from these roles that were being offered, these wholesome Julia Andrews roles she was being offered. And people misunderstand because both of those films, both Sound of Music and Mary Poppins, she is a lot harder than people think in certain moments. And you get caught up in the more sweeter moments of the movies, but she's pretty hard ass in certain moments of both of those movies. So I think it's people maybe overlooking that or misinterpreting the dimensions that she brought to the roles when she was performing them.
100%, 100% agree. And this scene is a perfect example
of
that.
Yes.
Now take Liesl.
You'll not say
she's
one word about
it. She's not a child
about,
anymore. One of these days you're going to wake up and find she's a woman. You won't even know her.
Now, when Captain Von Trapp tells you to shut up, everybody has always shut up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, whether it was on the U-boat, his kids, his servants, anybody he has dealt with, if he says, you will stop speaking, they stop speaking. And this is where I do think she has thought through this stuff, because no one's going to stop her, and she knows exactly what she wants to say. She just rolls right over him and says,
"And Friedrich, he's a boy, but he wants to be a man like you, and there's no one to show him
how. Don't you dare tell me about my son.
Brigitte could tell you about him if you'd let her get close to you. She notices everything. And Kurt pretends he's tough, not to show how hurt he is when you brush him aside.
That'll do.
The way you do all of them."
She's just not going to be denied.
Well, I mean, she has that line in the exchanges in this scene where she says, "Someone's got to tell you the truth. Someone's got to." And that's what she's doing. And she's doing it out of love for the children. She's trying to wake him up to what his behavior is doing to the children, because they're flourishing under her and they're not flourishing under him. And that's an issue.
And that's what she says. She says,
"Oh, please, Captain, love them. Love them all.
I don't care to hear anything further from you about my children.
I am not finished yet,
oh,
Captain."
Oh, yes, you are, Captain.
Which has always been a weird moment to me.
Rabbit season. Duck season. Rabbit season. It's basically tricked him into saying that.
And I think, too, is that the only arguments he's had like this are with other officers of equal rank in the military. You know what I mean? Because no one below his rank would speak to him this way.
Fräulein, now you will pack your things this minute and return to the Abbey.
Yeah, as he's saying this, and as she knows that she is probably lost and everything is hopeless, we hear the children singing.
What's that?
And the change in expression on Christopher Plummer's face, everything he does in this next sequence, is so powerful, and it just wrecks me.
It's singing.
Yes, I realize it's singing, but who is singing?
The children.
You see his whole face transform in that moment.
The children?
I taught them something to sing for the Baroness.
I think she has completely disappeared out of his mind at this moment, because what we find out later is that music actually was really important to him at a certain time. We don't know that at this point, but in his reaction, you can see it. And he goes inside, deeply, deeply moved. And we see him walk slowly through that main hallway. And now he sees them all dressed properly again. And you see him kind of watching, and then the slightest bob to his head to the rhythm of the music. And then he starts to mouth the words. And it's so funny. I get emotional thinking about it, because every time, it's not that I'm surprised. I've seen the movie many, many times, but
right.
The moment of like, oh my God, is he going to sing?
Oh yeah. Like, is he going to join them?
Right. Is he going to join them?
I go to the hills when my heart is lonely. I know I will hear what I've heard before.
He did sing on set. They did record Christopher Plummer, but they ended up not using his voice.
Ah.
And that the singer is a Disney singer, Bill Lee, who is in everything. He's in Jungle Book and Aristocats and all, you know, it's tons and tons of stuff. He's a working recording singer for Disney, and that he did the voice here. And when he comes in singing, the kids, their reactions are amazing. They stop singing and they look over at him. And if you, I freeze framed at one point, just randomly, every single one of them is having a different reaction to hearing their father sing. And part of this is what Charmaine says, is that she says, Charmaine Carr, who played Liesel, they were scared shitless of Christopher Plummer. And so when this moment happened, they had been working with him for a few weeks already, and it was all the scary scenes. So when this moment of, they were shocked and stunned, and some of them just started crying. She also says that Robert Wise was crying when he directed the scene.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's a beautiful scene. And, you know, when I watched it, I was like, oh, is the turn too quick? But because Maria has just dressed him down, and he's heard, and he combined it with the angelic sound of their voices singing together, you can understand why he makes the change that he does. And I wonder if, you know, we say the kids didn't sing, but it might have been the kids sang while the mom was around, or the mom sang the kids to sleep with that song. But there's something about it that absolutely shreds him emotionally. And he drops the hard-ass military personality, and he is now their father, their loving father, when he walks in the room. And it's amazing. And Plummer delivers a peaceful look on his face of utter joy of the situation. And incredible to watch.
And of course, Maria is watching them. And after they get over the shock, the kids all join in and they all sing together as a family.
And I'll sing once more.
It's really just a perfect, perfect movie moment. And the song ends and then he laughs and then something happens that we've never seen in the movie, which is he embraces all the kids, you know? And Maria is out in the hallway watching all this, also really moved. I love she gives like the littlest hand gesture for Gretel to go bring the Edelweiss to the flowers to the Baroness.
Edelweiss. You never told me how enchanting your children are.
And as this is happening, he suddenly, I think, remembers Maria. I think he'd totally forgotten her.
Yeah. You know,
even though they just had this intense fight.
Fräulein. I behaved badly. I apologize.
No, I'm far too outspoken. It's one of my worst faults.
You were right. I don't know my children.
And this is where you take a guy who's totally unlikable, you know, when we first meet him. And the fact that he apologizes immediately and acknowledges that he was right, that she was right, and just had this amazing moment with his family. Now I'm in on Georg. It totally turns your feelings about him.
There's still time, Captain. They want so much to be close to you.
And this is the line that made me ugly sob.
You brought music back into the house? I'd forgotten.
I think that's such a great line. By the way, the timing on this movie makes no sense at all. So in the real Von Trapp family, he's 25 years older than Maria, and he has adult children. He has a son who's a doctor, you know. There's a huge range. In this movie, you have a 16-year-old daughter in Liesl.
Yeah.
And a 5-year-old in Gretel. So the mom died at the longest ago when Liesl was 11. So the idea, and there was music in the house when mom was around. So the idea that Liesl doesn't know how to sing or any of that doesn't really make sense timing wise. Cause you know, this is 11 years.
Fräulein, I want you to stay.
Then he changes how he says it because he's used to giving orders.
I ask you to stay.
If I could be of any help.
You have already more than you know.
And he walks away, and the reaction from Julie Andrews on the stairs is just awesome. So you said you worried that the turn has come too early. And this is one of the things I wanted to bring up. This is a really weird movie because it's really three movies. Like, in general, you introduce them, like classic screenwriting structure. There's a main character, there's a main problem, and at the end of the movie, we're either going to solve that problem or we're going to fail to solve the problem. And so it's either going to be a happy ending or a sad ending. And that's it. You know, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Well, he's trying to get the Lost Ark. And at the end of the movie, he gets the Lost Ark. That's what that movie's about. You know, this movie starts off, how do you solve a problem like Maria? She goes to this family. This family is all messed up because dad is being a jerk. And that's the problem of the movie. And we have now solved the problem of the movie. The problem of the movie was dad and these kids. And that movie is now over. And now we're going into movie number two, which isn't about dad and the kids. Movie number two is a love triangle movie. That's very strange structure. And we go to just the music is rising and it's positive and it's joyful. It's like we're building off the positive, joyful reaction Maria had when she asked him to stay.
Yes, 100%.
And we're taking that energy and we're going right into the lonely goat herd done with puppets.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay, hoddle-lay. Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, hoddle-lay, hoddle-lo.
What is your reaction to this song?
The song itself is playful and fun and childish, but it's the puppets that's really fantastic about this scene. And the staging of them is so well done. And Julia and the rest of the cast singing the song is super sweet. But yeah, what an interesting thing to put in the movie. Like, I found the movie at times to be gratuitous with its singing scenes. Like, there's so much singing that you're just like,
this does not to be a, need to be a three-hour movie. Like, if we cut some of these numbers, they're basically reiterating what we've just done. Like, the puppets, you could totally lose the puppet scene. There's nothing that gets established, in my opinion, puppet scene, that you couldn't establish someplace else. But it's a way to show the music off and show their a cute little sequence in a musical with these puppets. So I get the logic behind it.
There's no story here.
Yeah,
I think is the thing. There's, and it's really interesting because initially, as I told you in the last part, Favorite Things was a song with the Reverend Mother. It's still at the Abbey.
Right, right.
Lonely Goat Herd is the song that's sung to calm down the children during the storm.
Yes, yes.
So this, so in those cases, again, I totally agree with movie Favorite Things to the scene with the kids. I think it works fantastic. But Lonely Goat Herd is a funny song to distract the kids from the scary thunder. That is its purpose in the stage play. Here, it serves no purpose. I totally like it. It's not a criticism of it as a musical number. I love it as a musical number, but it doesn't advance story at all. By the way, they had seen these, I believe, are local puppets that they found in Salzburg. It's Baird and Cora Eisenberg. What they did was, of anything that's really hard puppeteering, that's the puppeteers. But then they really encouraged the kids and Julie Andrews to get involved, and they were all bonding, and they all just had a blast learning how to do all this stuff. And I think it's a totally fun scene. And I should say, by the way, this is a puppet performance for Max and Georg and the Baroness, who are all sitting and watching this.
Right.
So they're already are becoming, this is how they're transitioning to be performers.
Can we really keep the puppet show, Uncle Max?
Yes, may we?
Of course you may, my darling. Why else would I have told Professor Conan to send the bill to your father?
So Max has apparently bought this whole puppet show.
Of course
him,
he is.
Or Georg has. I should say, by the way, that the character of Max is based on a real person.
Oh.
Who was is not a friend of the Baroness, because there was no Baroness.
Right.
And he is a clergyman whose name was Franz Wassner. And he is the person who taught the Von Trapp family to sing. Like, Maria sang a little bit and the kids sang. And this guy, Franz, who is an expert on music, heard them and said, no, you really could do this professionally. And he really trained them to be singers. And he's the person who got them into these festivals. And they were, you know, they started touring in the early 30s, not in the late 30s, and had been touring for years by the time we get towards World War II.
Well,
I really am very, very much impressed.
They're your children, Captain.
And then there's this little awkward moment with the Baroness who walks away with Georg, and you can see she is not pleased.
Oh, yeah. She's starting to sense a younger rival for the hand that she wants.
My dear, is there anything you can't do?
Well, I'm not sure I'll make a very good nun.
Oh. Well, if you have any problems, I'd be happy to help you.
She's like, you need to go back to the Abbey.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Let's get rid of this person.
I saw him first. Get out of here. Yeah, yeah. Plus, I mean, you can't ignore the fact that she's a younger woman than the Baroness as well.
It's a great line. It's also a great line because it's kind of a plant, because it's exactly what's going to happen by the end of the intermission. The Baroness is going to be very helpful in getting her back to being a nun.
Yeah. Helping her pack and then hiding the secret of what actually happened. That's a good point.
Attention, attention, everyone. I have an announcement to make. Surprise, surprise. Today, after a long and desperate search, I have finally found a most exciting entry for the Salzburg Folk Festival.
And Georg just thinks this is funny, the idea that we would sing.
I don't know what's so funny. You are, Max. You're expensive, but very funny.
But you heard them. There'll be a sensation.
No, Max.
It's a wonderful idea. Fresh, original.
Max, my children do not sing in public.
And so that's it. They're not going to sing in public. And then there's a question of, well, who's going to give the next performance?
The vote is unanimous. You, Captain.
No.
I'm told that a long time ago you were quite good.
Well, that was a very, very, very long time ago.
I remember, Father.
Play us something we know.
Please.
And they beg him, and finally and they hold out the guitar, and finally he takes it, strums it a little bit.
Why didn't you tell me?
What?
To bring along my harmonica.
Very, very passive aggressive.
Well, and it's also, this is where how non-show people do not understand show people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Because you've been at lots of parties where someone started singing a thing or playing the piano or did, because we're around people that are performers, you know?
Whether I liked it or not. Yeah. It happened. Yes. But I also think what we're about to witness here with him is, I think, a window into him. And I wonder if he's
if he was an artist or creative in some way, but seven kids, man, you got to provide. And so
he doesn't have to provide. What? He does. He doesn't have a job.
That's right. That's right. Well,
he's super rich.
I guess you're right. All right, fine. But I feel like he was a creative and then joined them and then had to join the military, or was maybe discouraged by his father from following the creative path because he has a creative's instincts in his politics, or some of, you know, some of the creative instincts in politics. And he literally picks up that guitar and starts playing. And then the fact that they say, you know, oh, it's been a bit, but there used to be music in this house. Like, clearly, and as you said, Steve, earlier, music was important to this guy. So clearly this guy has creative bones amidst his military structure. And I think that's what's coming through in these moments. And there's a tenderness to these moments when he's walking and the kids singing, and then when he's about to sing for the kids, and when he sings for the kids, that I think are so genuinely well played by Christopher Plummer. It's fantastic.
I hadn't occurred to me until you started saying this, but this actually makes a lot of sense to me, you know, because I love historical novels.
Yeah.
And obviously I've talked many times about the Patrick O'Brien novels, right. And, you know, these are military people. They met, their friendship started while listening to music, to like a small quartet playing at someone's house. And their friendship, the core of their friendship is that they play music together. And at the time, it was very, very common, you know, because we didn't have record players.
Right.
So people learned music and particularly in the aristocracy, they would learn music. And you would go, like, you remember, like, in Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice, they're always going somewhere and someone's playing the piano or the harpsichord or something like that. That's what, it's actually not contradictory for a military person or a member of the aristocracy to play music. You know, that's a sort of normal thing, which hadn't occurred to me, but yeah. So by the way, the song he's about to go into is Edelweiss, which is a beautiful song. It is the last song written for the stage musical.
Oh, okay.
When Dad came on to sing on stage at the end, he just sang with them. And they're like, we really need a Georg moment. He needs to have a moment. And we want something about Austria because of what is going on in the story at that point. And so Oscar Hammerstein was dying of stomach cancer, had just had major serious surgery.
Right
out of the hospital, wrote Edelweiss. And I think it's fairly short. I think he died the next year. Initially, in the stage musical, it's only at the end. And they decided they wanted to bring it in here to introduce it here. And I think it works great.
Edelweiss, Edelweiss, every morning you greet me, small and white, clean and bright, you look happy to meet me.
What do you think of this song, by the way?
Well, I think it's a very sweet song for what it is, and it's a nostalgic song for people from that country. Like, that's what I sense when he's singing the song. You know, the Hills Are Alive, the Sound of Music, that's a beautiful song, slower, belted out like a Broadway show tune. But this one is much more intimate and much more about something that is exclusively Austrian. And so there's a more weight to it.
This is the song I found myself singing in the shower.
Oh.
As I've been working on this.
Nice.
It's strangely enough, this and You Are 16 Going on 17 are the two that have been kind of stuck in my head. And this song, it's so simple and it's so moving and poetic. I just really love it. And structurally in the scene, watch Julie Andrews looking at Georg as he plays. Her smile is amazing. And then the Baroness notices Julie Andrews looking at Georg. And so it's just perfectly setting up the love triangle, that we're going to have here. And you can see as he sings the last line, there's a wistful quality to his voice. And you can see that he's thinking about all the things that are going on in his world.
Edelweiss, Edelweiss, bless my homeland forever.
There you go. And that's what I was just going to say, Steve. So yeah, absolutely correct. So I'm just going to underline your point. And that's why you put the song here at this time, so that you can, as an audience member, understand how much Austria means to him. So that when things happen in the back 30, 40 minutes of the movie, you understand the motivation. You understand the desire. Him snapping at a party guest, him snapping at Max, is not the same as him, you know, helping his family get away. Like, that's massive. And it's because he loves his country so much, you know?
Yep. Obviously, Maria is deeply moved by hearing Georg sing.
Yes.
But the more interesting thing is, who does Georg look to when he finishes the song? He doesn't look at the Baroness. He looks up at Maria, and the Baroness says,
I have a wonderful idea, Georg. Let's really fill this house with music. You must give a grand and glorious party for me while I'm here.
Party?
Yes. So, a little more history on the actual Von Trapps.
Okay.
So, they were well off. They were not this well off. But they had money. They had a large villa that then had some grounds. Most of the money, by the way, Georg married well. It was his wife where all the money came from.
Oh.
Not him.
Interesting.
And they did very well in the 20s, which is when the wife died.
Mm.
I think it's 1926, when Maria shows up. Then... the Depression happens, and the Von Trapps lose everything. They're real close to broke. They kept the house, but they had to close down most of the rooms. They had to dismiss all of the servants that used to work there. They're still bleeding money. So Maria decides to take in boarders. So in the 30s, they're actually taking in boarders to help keep the house so they don't lose the house. It's this reverend that had been training them, says, hey, you can make some money going to sing. And Georg is like, no, we shouldn't do that. But they're about to lose the house. And so finally he goes, okay, I guess you guys can go sing. He didn't participate in it.
Oh.
He also didn't feel that a gentleman should work. So he never got a job while they're taking in boarders and doing all that stuff. Georg thought it was an embarrassment that they were singing out in public, but they had no choice. And they became really, really well known. They did a large European tour in 1936. They were even invited to sing for Adolf Hitler's birthday.
Yikes.
Which they refused to do.
Oh, thank God.
We'll get more on that as we move along.
Okay.
But cut to a unbelievably gorgeous ballroom with people dancing, a large orchestra playing. And by the way, we should note that the music that they used all the themes from the songs as the score.
Oh, nice.
So you're constantly hearing favorite things or do re mi or things like that. You're constantly hearing those things in the background. Right now it's favorite things. And we see people arriving in their fancy cars, and we see the captain and the Baroness looking elegant. And we see a character who we'll come to know as Herr Zeller walk in and look up at this Austrian flag and does not look pleased.
I suppose you noticed the obvious display of the Austrian flag in the hallway.
This is Ben Wright, who's playing Herr Zeller. He worked as the radio incarnation of Sherlock Holmes in the 50s and late 40s. He has a small role in Judgment at Nuremberg. I don't know where he is in Judgment at Nuremberg. I couldn't place him. Maybe he's one of the German people they interview. Maybe he's... the person that Julia Louis-Dreyfus Judy Garland is accused of sitting on. I don't know what role he plays in the film, but he's in there. He was also in My Fair Lady and Billy Wilder's The Fortune Cookie. He also on TV was on My Three Sons, Hogan's Heroes as various Nazi officers. McHale's Navy, Combat, Get Smart, Bonanza, Gunsmoke. Yeah, he also did various alien voices on the Outer Limits series. He was the narrator in the 1963 Cleopatra film with Elizabeth Taylor. He was the BBC announcer in The Diary of Anne Frank, the movie that. And then he also was in several Disney animated films, 101 Dalmatians, as songwriter Roger Radcliffe, The Jungle Book as Mowgli's wolf father Rama, and recently, and the most recent in 1989 in Little Mermaid as Grimsby. He is the voice of Grimsby in My Little Mermaid 1989. So,
wow.
What a career, Mr. Wright. What a career.
And then we cut outside to Liesl, who is fantasizing about her being at a ball. And you can see her do very much what Maria did when she showed up in the ballroom alone at the beginning, which is she mimes being asked to dance. And then I don't know a lot of brothers that would do this move, but it's very cool of Friedrich to come up and ask his sister to dance.
Why didn't you children tell me you could dance?
We were afraid you'd make us all dance together. The Von Trapp family dances.
And then we hear this piece of music which they asked about, and she says...
It's the Ländler. It's an Austrian folk dance.
Show me.
Oh, Kurt, I haven't danced that since I was a little girl.
Oh, you remember. Please.
Well...
Please.
All right, come on over here.
And it is very cute, them dancing together. And you could see they're struggling because Kurt is so small. And then as they're dancing, Georg comes out and starts watching. And there's a particular moment where they do a spin that doesn't go well for Julie Andrews. And that's when Georg decides to cut in.
Do allow me, will you? Mm-hmm.
And the reaction from Maria, from Julie Andrews, is fantastic. And I think this dance scene is so perfect.
Well, this is why the medium of film is so great sometimes. Like, they say volumes without saying a word to each other in this dance, right? And you see the progression of the surprise of love between both of them, much more overtly for Maria because Maria is more, she expresses herself more openly than the captain does. But it's clear that by the end of the dance, they've walked through some portal and they're in a whole other timeline in their relationship. It's fascinating.
I couldn't agree more. And it's also the choreography tells the story. Mm-hmm. Their performances tell the story. Like, it's, you know what? It's exactly the opposite of what we were talking about with Lonely Goat Herd, which I totally like Lonely Goat Herd, but it doesn't advance the story at all. Every single moment in this dance advances the story and their relationship. And the choreographers spent a lot of time. This is a traditional Austrian folk dance, and they spent a lot of time trying to get it right while also advancing the story of the two of them. And as they are dancing together, and they have that just intense connection, that eye lock, you know, that you have when you're in love, you could just feel it. And as they're getting closer and closer, and you can see how moved both of them are, the Baroness comes out and watches. Then the song ends.
I don't remember anymore.
Your face is all red.
Is it? I don't suppose I'm used to dancing.
And she puts her hands on her face there. Because I'm sure you've had that, you know, it's like, oh, you noticed it? Like, oh no, like my emotions are coming out.
The reaction here was really fascinating and genuine. You know, the fact that she is surprised. It's probably the first time she's ever felt those feelings. And she almost regresses to being a teenage girl almost, right? Because she backs off away from him. She kind of yanks her head back. And then when she's reminded about her cheeks or told about her cheeks, she immediately shoves her faces on, like as if you can feel redness on your face, you know? And so she has all of these things at once. And it is, for her, it is embarrassing on so many levels. And that she is, and I think it surprises her, the feelings that she didn't sense were there and then all of a sudden show up. So the difficulty in processing all of that at the same time in front of a bunch of strangers, right? Who were of higher station in her mind. And so there's so much going on here that she has to play in this moment right after they finish dancing.
I don't think we give enough credit to the class distinction that's going on at this time between Georg and Maria. Yeah. You know, Maria is an orphan who was living at the Abbey and has nothing. And Georg is a member of the aristocracy who's also a famous, you know, military commander.
Right.
Plus, like, that's a long distance.
Plus, she didn't come here seeking love, right?
No.
This is something completely out of the blue.
Well, that was beautifully done. What a lovely couple you make.
What I find interesting about the Baroness's tactics is that it's to kind of go right at the thing.
Yes.
To state it rather than to avoid it.
Yes, I think it's time the children said goodnight.
Yes, we'll be in the hall in a moment. We've got something very special prepared, right?
Right.
Yes,
yes, yes, yes, come on.
And then the Baroness is alone with Georg and says...
All that needless worrying, Georg. You thought you wouldn't find a friend at the party.
Wolf. Wolf.
A bit chilly out tonight, isn't it?
No, I don't know. Seemed rather warm to me.
It's out of my note here is, yeah, now he gets it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the children of Captain Von Trapp wish to say goodnight to you.
And she gestures for everyone to come in the hall, which they do, and we go into so long farewell.
There's a sad sort of clanging from the clock in the hall and the bells in the steeple too. And up in the nursery an absurd little bird is popping out
Cuckoo.
The ultimate, maybe, of a movie filled with cutesy songs.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the cutesiest.
Yeah.
I feel like you were not a fan of this
song. I was not a fan. There's no need for this song. But if you've earned the viewer's trust, this is a very sweet song, you know, and they get to do little physical interactions that are unusual, the kicking in the butt, and then each of them getting their own exit. And Gretel crawling up the stairs backwards, or crawling, yeah, backwards with her line. So everyone gets a chance to sign. It's a very sweet moment. But yeah, I mean, so unnecessary.
Where I actually think I think there are too many songs in the performance at the Salzburg Music Festival.
Ah.
And the fact that we repeat them, it's like we repeat right. this, we repeat parts of Doe Deer, we repeat Edelweiss. Like, I think the combo definitely makes it too much for me. But it is super cute, and all the kids are super cute. And I love the moment as they're saying goodbye that the audience joins in the song
right.
to sing goodbye to them.
Goodbye.
It's very fun.
Yeah.
Max grabs Maria.
Georg, you're not going to let this girl get away. She has to join the party.
And Maria doesn't want to join the party. There's a bunch of really fancy people. And Max also says to the Baroness, you know, this is business. Like, he's trying, he is angling hard to get this singing group. They say to Franz.
Franz, set another place next to mine for Fräulein Maria.
And Franz looks over to Georg. Franz is not pleased with this idea at all.
No.
And it's so funny. Like, he was kind of a jerk at the door when we first met him.
Yes.
We have this moment, and then he's going to turn them into the Nazis.
Yep.
That's all we get from him, but it's enough to establish this character.
Well, it appears to be all arranged, doesn't it?
Certainly does. I'm not suitably dressed.
Well, you can change. We'll wait for you.
And this older couple comes up to Georg. They're very impressed with his youngsters, and they say,
is there a more beautiful expression of what is good in this country of ours than the innocent voices of our children?
And right in this moment where we're talking about what's good in this country of ours, up comes our Nazi, which is Herr Zeller.
Oh, come now, Baron. Would you have us believe that Austria alone holds a monopoly on virtue?
Herr Zeller, some of us prefer Austrian voices raised in song to ugly German threats.
Damn.
I know. To be fair, you know, he's kind of up in the ante here with a little bit of a pushback. So
yeah, not just a little bit. Well, it's funny too. I think Georg did put up that Austrian flag on purpose.
Oh, 100%.
To make a statement. He's not really? Being coy about his feelings about the Third Reich.
He's a soldier.
Yeah.
You know, he's trained to fight.
Perhaps those who would warn you that the Anschluss is coming, and it is coming, Captain, perhaps they would get further with you by setting their words to music.
If the Nazis take over Austria, I have no doubt, Herr Zeller, that you will be the entire trumpet section.
And I love this last little bit. He says,
you flatter me, Captain.
Oh, how clumsy of me. I meant to accuse you.
I wrote down, badass. We're up in Maria's room where ostensibly she's trying to find a dress to change into. And the Baroness has come with her. And Maria is super uncomfortable, period, that she has to join this party. But she's really uncomfortable that the Baroness is there.
Now, where is that lovely little thing you were wearing the other evening when the captain couldn't keep his eyes off you?
I think the tactic that the Baroness uses here is fascinating. Because you wouldn't think that what you should say to a person who is obviously in love with your dude when you're worried that that dude is attracted to her, you wouldn't say it because that seems like you're encouraging it. But that is the direction the Baroness takes.
I think Maria gives away the angle that the Baroness needs to take. When Maria is like, oh, no, I don't want to be part of this. Oh, I don't have anything to wear. I don't. So she knows or senses, and women know women. She knows, I imagine, or she senses that if she pushes her to show what's actually happening, it'll be too much for her and Maria's going to run away. And that's what I think she's doing here by putting it out on the table and then increasing the ante with every exchange between them. It becomes a situation where she has to, it overwhelms Maria, you know,
yep.
Too much to ask of her.
Couldn't keep his eyes off me. Come, my dear, we are women. Now let's not pretend we don't know when a man notices us. Here we are.
The captain notices everybody and everything.
There's no need to feel so defensive, Maria. You are quite attractive, you know.
And again, she's been several years, I think, in the Abbey, and then was a kid. Like, she doesn't have a lot of experience with men.
But I've never done a thing to... You don't have to, my dear. There's nothing more irresistible to a man than a woman who's in love with him.
Again, the Baroness is just saying everything out loud. She's saying the quiet part out loud, which is so interesting. Do you think Maria has had the thought that she is in love with the captain before this moment?
No, not until the moment at the dance. That's when it dawned on her that there was something more here. And as the night has progressed, you know how it is. Once you see a truth, Steve, you can't unsee it. And the truth becomes even more overwhelming to process because you didn't see it before. And so now everything has to be reprocessed through that prism, that new prism. And so I think that's what's going on here for her.
Well, and I think you're totally right about the Baroness reading Maria, because then she now is keeping her perfectly off balance with every line. Because now Maria is struggling with not only struggling with this new idea that she might be in love with the captain, but then she's like, oh my God, it's obvious that I might be in love. Like, the Baroness has said it. So that's like, oh God. And then the next thing the Baroness says is going to put her even further off her balance. Because she says,
what makes it so nice is he thinks he's in love with you.
Which again, in my mind, is like, well, that's the opposite of what you said. You know, the man I want to marry, I'm telling the person that he is in love with that he is in love with her and that she loves him. That seems like a really strange tactic.
But that's not true. Surely you've noticed the way he looks into your eyes. And you know, you blushed in his arms when you were dancing just now.
And Maria is embarrassed and off balance and unsure of what to do.
Then I should go. I mustn't stay here.
And she just starts packing. You know what I hadn't thought about, but is that this is the perfect contrast between the scene, between this and the scene where she stands up to Georg to tell him about his children after she falls in the lake. Because there she is 100% confident, 100% sure of what is right and what she should do. And now she is absolutely not. And she starts packing. And I think, watch the Baroness, man, because you can see all sorts of emotions playing. If you just listened to this and you didn't watch her, you would just go, well, she's horrible. She's like totally manipulated this situation to freak Maria out and to get rid of her rival. But if you watch her, she feels bad or she feels stuff, you know? I'm not 100% sure what her feelings are, but there are definitely feelings there.
Please don't say a word about this to the captain. No. No, I wouldn't dream of it.
And then the next line is so perfect.
Goodbye, Maria. I'm sure you'll make a very fine nun.
What's your feeling about the Baroness?
Again, I don't think she's overtly evil. And I don't think...
No, I don't either.
Yeah, and I don't think she's, you know, being mean. I think she's... She has a role to play. There's a man that she wants to be with. There's a younger, prettier rival. And nothing against Eleanor Parker, who's a very striking woman. But it's Julie Andrews. And
yeah,
she has seen the Baron's... She has seen... the captain's face when he looks at her. And so I think this scene is not just for Maria. It's for the Baroness as well. It's not just the Baroness not pushing, but certainly, you know, gently nudging Maria out the door. But it's also for the Baroness to come to the reality of the situation and the fact that he's in love with someone else. And she knows he's in love with someone else. And it's Maria. Instead of just being like, you know what, I'm getting out of here. Clearly you're in love with this woman. I can't be a part of this, which happens later, obviously. She does what she does here to kind of reclaim her standing or her status in a way. So that's what I see that by the end of the scene. And there's, I think there's a little bit of feeling bad about it by the end of the scene in her face.
I agree. And you know, it just occurred to me that I hadn't thought about is, the world that the Baroness lives in, which is high-end Vienna with very, very fancy people.
Yeah, the aristocracy. So.
I think, and particularly in this era or older eras in Europe, it was pretty normal for gentlemen to have a dalliance on the side.
Yes.
Very accepted. And I think that the Baroness is like, maybe that's part. It's like, yeah, okay, he's in love with you. Like, that's fine. That's going to happen lots of times.
Right.
As long as I'm the one in charge, you know.
Yeah.
Then that's just kind of how society works, you know. But obviously, I'm not going to mention all of these. But like, I think it's perfect that the score right now is playing a version of Edelweiss as Maria is heading out, because that's his song. You know, we're back at the ball, and the Baroness spots Max.
I feel like celebrating. Cheers.
You know something?
Perhaps.
Then if you're so clever, tell me how to get our little Fräulein to use her influence with Georg. I want those children in the festival. Elsa, this is important to Austria.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just so, like, you know how I said that I think they did just a perfect job of peppering in the Nazis with Rolf and Franz, and we're building to that? I think the peppering in of Max's desire to sign these kids is ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, if it's a matter of influence, maybe the one you'll have to be talking to is me.
And she hands off the glass and goes to grab Georg. And then we cut to Maria back in that same outfit that she was when she arrived at the Von Trapp family house with her guitar case as she sneaks down the stairs, hearing the music playing, and she pulls a note out, which she leaves on the table, then grabs her guitar, slowly backs out, and the door opens and closes, leaving an empty room as we fade to black. And that is the end of Act One of The Sound of Music. It's a great cliffhanger, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree. And, you know, we're back to the Maria with the hat, with the guitar case, all of that. It's like we've come back to the beginning of the film, you know, and now she's going away. The Baroness has staked her claim. And the captain seems unbothered that Maria has not shown up or not come back, and is going along with things. So, yeah, and leaves the note. I mean, the note is really important as well. It's how it plays to the kids later. But like, these things in your mind, you're like, no, come back. He loves you. Where are you going? And you want to feel that as an audience before you go to the intermission.
And since it's intermission, John, I think it's a perfect place to end part two of our exploration of The Sound of Music. Of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts. You can visit us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. And if you didn't know, that's CINE-FILES. You can also follow us on Twitter, which is Cine_Files, on Instagram at Cinephiles Podcast. And you can subscribe to the show, if you haven't already, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We're starting to get those Spotify end-of-year wrap-ups, which are always kind of fun. You could subscribe there. Please leave your review on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts if you can. If you want to leave comments on YouTube, we love interacting with you there. You can support the show at patreon.com/thecinephiles or through Apple Podcasts. And you could buy or stream The Sound of Music along with every movie we've ever reviewed on cinephiles.net. And if you want to reach me, it's SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. And guess what, John? It's SR Morris on Blue Sky. So I'm there on Blue Sky. I have not done anything yet. I haven't posted anything yet. I've followed At The Roca Says there and a few other people that I know, and that is all I've done. But I'm starting out on the Blue Sky thing, and as everyone who listens to the show knows, I am an expert at social media. It is my life's blood. So naturally, I'm sure I'll be all over there in no time. John, how would people reach you?
Naturally. You can find me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Blue Sky as well, at The Roca Says. Please come and follow me there and grow my numbers on Blue Sky. And if you want to see more of my content, you can head over to the Outlaw Nation channel, the YouTube channel, youtube.com/JohnRocaSays, or listen to my other podcasts, The Geek Buddies and The Hot Mic, that are separate feeds that you can download and enjoy as well.
And so I think that is it for this week, and we will be back next time to conclude our exploration on The Sound of Music, right here on The Cinephiles.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach. Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.